The Sportsman's Nation is a 2% for conservation certified business. And on August 21st, you can join other conservationists all over the world in supporting Community Conservation Day. It's a day for anyone to give their time and or dollars back to their local ecosystems and favorite conservation causes. For more information on how you can participate, visit fishandwildlife.org.
Welcome back to the Backcountry Rookies podcast. I'm your host, Chad Riker, and Backcountry Rookies was designed to prepare, inspire, and educate hunters to head west for their backcountry big game hunt. Join us as we talk to some of the most experienced hunters in the West about their tips and tricks to help you along your journey to get out west for big game hunting. We also share some of our good, bad, and ugly experiences that we've had along the way. Kick back and enjoy the show. Hey, welcome back to the Backcountry Rookies podcast. I'm your host, Chad Riker. And this week I have another shared episode like I did last week. If you listened to last week's show, you might remember that I said I was in the middle of a move and I've got family in town and just kind of life took over all at once. So I've been a little bit busy. What I did last week and this week is I'm sharing an episode from a friend of mine where I was a guest on there and they were kind enough to give me their audio files so that I could share their show with you guys, with the Backcountry Rookies audience. This week Dan Johnson from the Sportsman's Nation podcast network has me on as a guest. And we just talk about the origins of the Backcountry Rookies. We talk about some hunter bio profile type stuff where we go back before I was hunting, time in the military, time after the military, where I'm at now, what's going on now, just a lot of good background type of stuff. So I like to do these origin type of shows occasionally for the new listeners. We're constantly getting new listeners to the show and maybe some older listeners that just aren't aware of the roots or the origins of the Backcountry Rookies. I like to do these every now and then so that people get an idea of where we came from and kind of the where it all began. This time it's a little different perspective. I'm on the interviewee side of the microphone instead of the interviewer side. So little different perspective. Either way, enjoy the show. Next week, we should be back to the regular schedule style of program. Things are getting back to normal after this move, and it should be we should be good to go. So I'm looking forward to getting back to normalcy. And here you go. Let's jump into this with Nine Finger Chronicles. So there's a quick commercial here from the sponsors. And then when we come back, it'll be Dan's show from Nine Finger Chronicles. And we'll get into it. Thanks for listening. Backcountry Rookies is proudly sponsored by Go Hunt Insider. Research the hunts that you want and get rid of the hunts you don't want. With Go Hunt Insider draw odds and strategy articles, you are able to research exactly what you want out of a hunt. Go Hunt Insider is your key ingredient to drawing a tag this season. Use the code ROOKIES when you become an Insider member and get $50 to spend in the Go Hunt gear shop. Elk 101's University of Elk Hunting. University of Elk Hunting provides you with immediate access to the most comprehensive and complete resource for increasing your elk hunting knowledge, confidence, and success. University of Elk Hunting now has all of those resources in the palm of your hand on a mobile app. Use the code ROOKIES and save $20 on your University of Elk Hunting membership today. Vortex Optics is an American-owned and veteran-owned company. Vortex Optics designs, engineers, produces, and distributes a complete line of premium sport optics, accessories, and apparel. They're dedicated to providing unrivaled customer service and exceptional quality. Vortex backs its products with unconditional, transferable, lifetime VIP warranty. If it breaks, they fix it or replace it. And remember, you can use the code ROOKIES and save 20% off of Vortex apparel.
3, 2, 1. All right, on the phone with me today, my Sportsman's Nation brother, Chad Riker. How are we doing, man?
I am doing very, very good, Dan. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you a turkey guy?
You know what? This will be my first year really hunting turkeys. I've hunted them in the past, but I just don't. To say I'm a turkey guy, no. Yeah. To me, turkey is more of a camp out and maybe go shoot something.
Right, right. Yeah. I'm only a turkey guy during turkey season. Like I don't, I don't go out and get all fired up and, you know, like most of the time I'm just wearing like a pair of Carhartt pants and a brown jacket, walk into the woods, call them. If they come in, I shoot them. If they don't, then I don't, but
it can be fun.
It can be fun.
Yeah, we'll see. So this year, my buddy, my partner in sportsman's in the backcountry rookies, Jordan, he is a turkey guy and he really enjoys turkey hunting. So this year he's going to come out and we're going to do the whole thing, the decoys and all the calls and setups. And we're going to try the whole thing and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
We'll see.
So you're living in New Mexico right now, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I did a podcast with the National Wild Turkey Federation and a biologist out of I'm pretty sure it was New Mexico. They had a huge multi-million-dollar project that they helped with between the state of New Mexico and the Wild Turkey Federation. That like this whole mountainside, they did all this habitat work and helped it, and to help not only the turkey population, that was one of the big factors, but all these other things. I mean, all the way down to the fish in the stream. So I don't know how close it is to where you're going to be, but they had a huge project on it. It's a very interesting story, a very interesting conservation project that those two organizations did, and basically the turkey population in that area kind of rebounded in the past couple of years.
That's great, and I think New Mexico does a pretty good job of managing their game and their wildlife here. Although this year we do have, this year could be happening for years in the past, but I'm really introduced to it now because I just moved here. But we've had a couple of bills that are pushing through the government of New Mexico right now that are pretty anti-hunter, anti-hunting. One of them has to do with trapping and predators. Yep. And that one is actually on the governor's desk right now for her to sign. It's already passed all the way through Senate, House, and everything. So, but it is good to hear that Wildlife Federation and turkey wildlife guys are getting out there and still getting after it, because if we don't, then it's going to, obviously this government down here is going to try to take away what we got.
Yeah. I mean, this blows me away. All of these things that they're trying to take away from good people. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
I'm going to play devil's advocate, and what I'm about to say does not reflect my actual thought, but I'm going to try to put myself into the shoes of someone who thinks completely opposite of the way that I do, just for a moment, so I can have some kind of empathy into the way that some of these decisions are made and the way people think. So let's just say, for example, the Second Amendment argument, right?
Yep.
And all these people out there, well, geez, man, we got to take away guns, all the guns, because guns hurt people. And that's all they see on the news, right? Guns hurt people all this stuff.
Sure.
So I can see for a short period of time why, just put myself in their shoes, why that might be some kind of an issue, right? Like they see the pain and suffering that's caused by a gun and maybe, whatever. And then obviously here comes all the rebuttals their way. But what I don't understand is there's obviously some dipshits out there, but for the most part, hunters, trappers, guys who run dogs, because that's another one, of bear hunting. Mm-hmm. Like these are all just good people trying to live their lives, and they're doing it in a tradition or a hobby or whatever you want to call it that's been around since the founding of the nation, and they've never hurt anybody or done anything to the other side. And I don't understand why we are such a big attack when there's all these other problems that, combined we could try to solve.
Yeah, it's oftentimes I think it's just an easy way to lobby through other stuff, and it's and other stuff. I use that very, very loosely because who knows what it is,
right?
And I think that's what happened down here. This whole thing with the trapping, it literally started because someone's dog, their pet, got caught in a trap.
Oh, Jesus.
And instead of being on the side of, man, maybe we should put pets on leashes when we're out in public lands, right? So that they don't possibly bite a person or do something, you know, something like that. It went to, okay, we got to get rid of all trapping.
Right.
And that's where it is now. You know, somebody's dog got trapped and now it's all of it's, there's a really good, there's a organization out there called Blood Origins. And he just did a really good video on this New Mexico trapping bill talking about the why it's so ridiculous. But anyway, yeah. So New Mexico has been a good state for me to be in. I just need to get more familiar with the regs and policies and stuff down here.
Yeah. All right. So let's kind of go all the way back. I want to start at the very beginning with you. What state were you born in?
So I was born and raised in Indiana and lived there pretty much all the way through into adult life.
Yeah.
You know, so I spent most of my days out there beating around the woods and goofing off in cornfields and trying to find trouble where I could.
Yeah. So did you come from a hunting family? I mean, your dad or brothers or uncles or whatever, were they hunters?
Yep. Yeah. Everybody was a little bit. They weren't like super, super hunters. My dad hunted raccoons a lot. He was a coon hunter, ran dogs. We always had coon dogs growing up. Kind of into deer hunting a little bit. My uncles were into deer hunting a little and fishing, just kind of outdoors. Everybody was always involved in the outdoors. You know, one of my uncles had a lake house and we would go to the lake house and go fishing and hang out on the boat and just kind of outdoors people.
Gotcha. So when it comes to, you know, your youth in Indiana all the way up into, let's just say your 20s or whatever. Were you serious about like, let's just say deer hunting at all? Or was it just, it was kind of something to do?
Something to do. I did it with my dad when I first could get my license. You know, you get that youth license and my dad took me out deer hunting a few times. I was never successful. We small game hunted a lot, squirrels and rabbits and that kind of stuff. And I always enjoyed it. My house, I had a big woods that backed right up to the backyard. And, you know, back then you'd just let your kids run wild. So me and my brother would, we'd go play in the woods for hours and hours and hours all day if we could. Couple little 22 rifles, you know, and run around shooting squirrels and rabbits and things.
Yeah.
But deer hunting, I never really got into deer hunting as a kid. It was something I kind of started to get into it in my late teens, but it just never took priority. There was at that time I was chasing girls and, you know, goofing off and just doing other teenage
and
early 20s, but just doing what kids do. So,
So then after that, like, you're a military guy. So when did the military come into play? How old were you?
I was 24 or 25 when I joined the military. So I was going through the motions, life motions, you know, I had graduated school and I tried college and did that for a little while. And then I just started working a job and it was actually a really, really good job. It was a factory job, but it paid really well and I enjoyed it and had a good friend network. And September 11th happened.
Ah, one of those guys.
I was totally one of those guys. So I worked nights at the time, and I remember September 11th, I woke up that morning. I see everything that was going on the TV, you know, and watching the news. And later that day, I went to work. And halfway through that night, I took a half a day off of work. I went to the bar, drank like 3 or 4 beers, and went home, went to bed, and September 12th, I woke up and went to the recruiting station and joined.
Just
like that. No question, no nothing. It was something that was on my mind previous, you know, always thought, man, I wonder if this would work out for me or if it was my thing. And then September 11th happened and kind of sealed the deal. Yeah.
Was that are you Army or Marine Corps?
Army. Yeah.
Okay.
I did. Yeah. Retired from the Army.
Yeah.
So that was obviously that was a long time ago, you know, September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
I retired medically. I had an injury that forced me into retirement at 18 years. So I didn't quite finish my 20 years, but
right.
I did my 18 and I certainly earned every minute of those 18, multiple deployments back and forth and Purple Heart been blown up a couple times, just, you know, tore it up and it was time to hang it up. So,
yeah. Yeah. I tell you what, just lasting that long into it, it takes balls to get blown up and go back. I mean, you know what I mean? Like a lot of people, myself included, probably would have hung it up after the first time I got blown up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. It rings your bell. And so my first 7 or 8 years, I think, I don't remember dates exactly, but my first several years were combat arms and running and gunning and, you know, out there, out in the front lines doing all the fun stuff, really. That's when I look back at it. I had a blast. But, and then I got, I ended up getting wounded pretty bad. And then I changed my job because I knew I wasn't going to be able to sustain in what I was doing.
Yeah.
So I switched my job and went to something a little more desk related and I finished out my career that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that sounds like what a lot of people do. You know, all the guys all the military guys that I've talked to here, you know, on this podcast, they say the same thing. And then so you join the military. What was the outdoors like in that 7 years, in that first 7 years? I mean, it sounded like you were deployed quite a bit. You were, like you said, running and gunning. Were you doing any outdoor activities when you would come back to the States at all?
I was in Germany. I was stationed in Germany for my first few years. So I was doing outdoor activities, but it was hiking and stuff. And I wasn't really, you know, when I joined the Army and there was, when I got to Germany, there really wasn't, it's there, there's hunters there and it goes on, but it just wasn't a network of people that I was really involved with, certainly in a foreign country, to be able to figure all that out. So all of it went on the back burner and I didn't really think twice about it, but I spent a lot of time in the mountains, hiking around and just enjoying the European nature, I guess. Yeah. And then I went to Hawaii after Germany and I got outdoors a lot in Hawaii, but again, it was still just hiking and spending time, you know, hiking to waterfalls out in the mountains and doing cool stuff in the mountains. But again, I never got into hunting and I wish that I would have over there because there is some awesome hunting in Hawaii.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not the first guy to say that. I'm trying to think of a guy that I talked to, I would say in the past couple months. He's military and he's stationed out in, he was stationed out there in Hawaii and he's like, man, I didn't catch the bug while I was out there. But now I regret not going after what they got, the axis deer out there.
Yeah. They got axis deer,
wild goats,
wild hogs.
Yeah.
Goats.
Yeah.
And those Hawaiian sheep. I did fish a lot when I was over there. I got into spear fishing and I spent a lot of time in the ocean, but I just didn't really hunt in the mountains.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So after, okay. So you go from Indiana to Germany to Hawaii. Where's your next step?
Yep. So I got married in Hawaii, married my wife, and then I had to go through a bunch of training because that's about the same time that I had switched my job. So there was some training. I went to Georgia for several months to do some stuff, and then we ended up in Arizona. And again, I wasn't really into hunting there, but so this is where the bug kind of really started, the big game hunting bug, if you will. And that came from, so my wife's family is big hunters and not really like Western style hunters, but they're all from Texas And my father-in-law is a ranch manager. So I would have opportunities to go out on these big Texas ranches and check out mule deer. And there's elk and stuff down there in Texas, too, that a lot of people don't know about. There's a big herd. Audad sheep, just all kinds of really cool animals. And that was where I started to get exposed to it, was going out to the ranch and spending time on the ranch with my in-laws and just kind of seeing those opportunities there. And then that bug led me to ultimately, you know, it led me to, well, I can't always hunt in Texas because it's very, very expensive,
right?
And it's mostly private land. So what other opportunities do I have at that point? And that led me to, I want to say it was a YouTube video of Randy Newberg. And it was one of Randy's public land advocate videos that he was doing where he talked about the opportunities on public land.
Yeah.
And that totally opened everything up for me at that point.
Man, I don't know. Randy Newberg has probably started more guys either from scratch or
yep.
getting back interested in hunting than yep. I know. Cause I had some other guy from California. He was watching rap videos on his YouTube channel yep. and all of a sudden yep. here comes a random Randy Newberg video. He clicked on it. And the next day the guy went out and bought a bow and arrow, like just like yeah. that. So, yeah.
Well, so mine's pretty similar. So I was actually at this time I was deployed into Central America. I was running around down in there doing some cool stuff. And one of my buddies said, hey, let's listen. We were a team down there and we had our own vehicle and stuff and we were cruising around. And he says, hey, do you mind if I listen to this podcast? And I didn't even know what a podcast was. And I was like, sure, dude, whatever. It beats whatever's on the radio. And he puts in a podcast and I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Well, the next day we're driving around again and he says, hey, so you don't know what a podcast is. Check this out. And it was a Joe Rogan podcast with Cameron Haynes.
Yeah.
And those two got to talking about hunting and whatever. Okay. So that was interesting to me. I listened to it and, you know, Joe Rogan's a pretty interesting guy. So I listened to that and that sort of put the idea in the back of my mind. And then the video came up. We were in a hotel somewhere staying and I like to shoot long range and that's how mine was. So I was watching long range shooting videos and Randy Newberg pops up randomly and I watched that. So here I have this introduction through this podcast and then this Randy Newberg video that explains how easy it is to do this Western style hunting stuff. And I thought, well, that's something I got to try.
Yeah.
And I started sort of planning right about that point for my first, would have been my first hunt. So,
yeah. So
yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Me and you were introduced to each other after you got back from Central America at that point, right?
Yep. So when I got back from Central America, I had decided I was going to start my own podcast. So by this time, because I had so much time in a vehicle and I was able to listen to a bunch of podcasts and now I understood what a podcast was, I decided I wasn't really hearing the information that I wanted to hear on all of these other things I was listening to. And I thought, why put hours and hours and hours of all these other people's podcasts? I'll just start my own and I'll get my own questions answered, you know?
Yep.
So I decided, well, you know, right? Obviously.
Yep.
So I decided that's when I decided to start my own. And I had put together, I think before we were introduced, I had recorded like four or five podcasts.
Yeah.
And I called you to be a guest on my show. And you were like, hey, man, of course I'll be a guest on your show. But let's talk about the Sportsman's Nation podcast network yeah. because I like the idea of your backcountry rookies and I like all of that idea. So before I ever even had an episode out, I joined the
yeah.
Sportsman's Nation before I even had an episode. And then you started pushing them out from there.
Yeah. So yeah. I want to talk to you, you know, you mentioned it a little bit there, but I think there's something bigger here that you need to maybe discuss. And that is like just the name alone. Makes mm-hmm. makes your podcast relatable, right? Like
yeah,
backcountry rookies. Yeah. I am a backcountry rookie. right? Sure. I would say that you're still under that category of backcountry rookie.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
And I don't know, like, me living in Iowa, I don't know if I'm ever going to get out of the backcountry rookie category, right? I think I'll be there for a while. But what was the whole point of this? Why backcountry rookies? And I know you mentioned you wanted to get some of your other questions answered, but I think it goes a little deeper than that.
Oh, most definitely. So very appropriately named podcast without even really knowing that at the time that I was appropriately naming it. Mm-hmm. I knew that I didn't know what I was doing, right? And I kicked around some ideas, and I just came up with the idea of admitting that I didn't know anything about hunting elk or big mule deer out west or anything like that, which I think is one of the things that makes us a little bit unique, is that myself and Jordan and the rest of the guys, we're not scared to say we don't know what we're doing.
Oh yeah.
And there's a lot of people out there that have no idea what they're doing, but they're the expert no matter what.
Fake it. Yep.
Yeah. Fake it till you make it. That's never been my style. I didn't learn that way in the Army. I failed so many times before I was successful that I don't mind saying that I've never done something before. And so we named it that. And then in the very beginning, I had a guy that was kind of a partner with us. And unfortunately, our schedules and everything just didn't work out. And he wasn't able to stay on. But he would always say, well, what happens in who knows if a podcast is even going to be around in 10 more years. But in 10 years, what happens then? Do we change the name? And I said, well, no, of course you don't change the name, because it isn't really about us being backcountry rookies. It's about the guy that just watched his first Randy Newberg video on YouTube.
Right.
And that guy's the backcountry rookie. And if he wants to go back and sort through 170 episodes of podcasts and find the topics that he wants, hopefully we can answer that guy's questions and we can help that guy. And that's what it was more about. And ultimately that's how that name was developed. When I developed it, I thought about us and the other people too that might need information. So,
So there are a lot of people who listen to this podcast that are interested in going west, let's say.
Yep.
And experience that backcountry hunt, whether it's for antelope, elk, mule deer, whatever game out west you want to go hunt, mm-hmm. bear. So talk to me about your first experience and how you may be prepared for your first ever quote unquote backcountry hunt.
Absolutely. So it's that first backcountry hunt is probably, I won't say scary. It's not a scary thing, but it's a little bit intimidating.
Right.
Because there's a lot of people that have never, especially from out east, right? There's a lot of people, they may have climbed around in the Appalachian Mountains and they might have hunted some, but there's some people that have never been into Colorado or some of the big mountains and even experienced it. So there's some intimidation there when you start thinking about hunting in the mountains. And then to caveat on that too, there's a lot of intimidation the first time that you drive up to those mountains and you look at them and you think, oh my God, I got to climb these things.
Yep.
But I think that first hunt, you should be intimidated. And I just think that a lot of people, and I blame social media and YouTube and all these other avenues, facets for this, but people think that they need to be successful in that first year.
Oh yeah.
And I think so in that first couple of years, I think success should never be on your mind. And well, I mean, it should be, but it shouldn't be in the forefront of your mind. You need to be able to educate yourself on what to be prepared for and accept the fact that you may come home with empty coolers and you're going to come home and you're going to be very, very tired and your legs are going to hurt bad because it's going to kick your butt real bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. But don't shy away from it either. Yeah. Go out there and try it, you know? And if you try to climb that mountain and you get to 9,000 feet and you can't go any higher, well, guess where you're elk hunting? Yeah. You're elk hunting at 9,000 feet and below.
Yeah.
And you just try your best to do what you can.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you this. On my couple, my first couple hunts, like backcountry hunts, I think the biggest thing for me, it wasn't necessarily the fear of going out and getting my butt kicked by the elements. You know, my first elk hunt ever was pretty much a major disaster as far as like I had a hole in my tent. It rained. I had to get off the mountain, go into town, buy a new tent. I prepared physically wrong for it. I packed the wrong food. It was like all Cliff Bars. So it was like, so it was just like a brick of food, right?
Yeah.
Bricks of food. So it weighed a lot. And then from there, it was like, then I just got my ass kicked physically. So go back to the drawing board. And I think for me, the next couple times that I went elk hunting, and even into my first solo mule deer hunt, was I had the physical conditioning better. You know, maybe not exactly, mm-hmm. but it was better than the previous time. That was a learning experience. But for me, I was overwhelmed with the gear list. What do I bring versus what do I not need to bring? So I always go on the side of caution and bring mm-hmm. way more than I should, just in case. So when it comes to like preparing and not knowing what to prepare for, like how did you handle that?
So that first year I watched every video I could, right? And I listened to every podcast I could that was about gear, and I bought everything that I could. I used a lot of my military gear, so I was able to save some money, but I spent that first couple of years is expensive to elk hunt. I don't care how many people tell you, hey, I hunt to save money and feed my family. That ain't the case. That will never be the case. You're never going to save money by hunting. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
But I went through all of the different gear and all the different gear lists, and I bought all the stuff, and I will be 100% honest with you. I don't use any of that gear anymore that I started with.
Yeah.
It's all been sold likely for a loss. I've bought new stuff that works better for me. And I think the point that I'm trying to make is if it's your first year, even if you've never been before, but you're 100% dedicated that you're going to go every year after this first year, don't go crazy on gear. You just don't need what you think you're going to need when you get there.
Yeah.
Solid Piranha Stretch Zion pants for $60 work great. Or even you can buy Wrangler pants at Walmart that are quick drying, and they're like $25, and they do everything that some of these expensive camo brands are going to do.
Right.
And they work fantastic. Same thing with tops and base layers. And I, one of these things that makes me laugh, this is a quick tangent and then I'll come back. But it makes me laugh because this new saying that I keep hearing people say is cotton kills, right?
Yeah.
And people are trying to get you to buy these $100 to $150 base layers when cotton doesn't kill. I wear cotton every day in the Army and I never died.
Yeah.
And I put it through a lot worse conditions than what I would have in any backcountry scenario.
Right.
But anyway, you can get by with stuff that you probably have in your closet. You can get by out there.
Yeah.
Especially if you're already a hunter.
Yeah.
But another thing I tell people is don't overthink the gear list, get the basics, get the essentials, and buy a cheap tent and camp from your truck.
Yeah.
And then hunt out of your truck, because you really will save a ton of money, and you're going to learn a lot about yourself and how to use gear and the gear that you need by just doing day trips. You know, drive to a new area, hike in 2 or 3 miles, bugle, do your calls, do whatever it is that you're going to do, spend the whole day out there, and then go back to your tent that night and get a good night's rest.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think me and you are on the same page, and I think we've discussed this on a previous podcast about gear, and you know, you don't necessarily need to go crazy overboard with it. Obviously there's some gear that, you know, may have some better functionality, maybe have some better performance on it. But if you're going for 3 days a year, you don't need that kind of stuff.
No, not at all.
No.
So since I've moved out here, I live here in Albuquerque, and we have beautiful mountains right here. Right, my wife and I were out hiking in them yesterday. We got up to about 8,500 feet, and she goes everywhere I go, and she's got on a pair of, you know, decent boots, and basically she's not wearing all this hunting stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not all this overpriced hunting stuff. And she goes everywhere I go.
Yeah.
And she's got some good trekking poles that help her get up the hills. And she's got, like I said, decent boots and appropriate clothing, and she's good to go.
Yeah. Now, did you, for some of your very first ever backcountry hunts, where maybe you were going to use a tent, maybe you were going to hunt out of the back of your truck, did you do any type of physical preparation, like working out or anything?
I did. So the first, again, I have to refer to a deployment, but the first year that I was going to my first elk hunt, I actually ended up getting these last minute orders. And again, I had to go to Central America for a second time. So I was trying to train while I was down there, but I was at very low elevation. So really all that I could do was put a backpack on, and I had taken my boots with me, and I would just get in some weighted hikes just to try to get, I knew if anything, like I wasn't going to be able to train for elevation, but if anything, I would have my body ready to carry a pack all day for long periods of time.
Yeah.
And I would go out and do, you know, I'd leave early in the morning and I'd go do 5 or 6 miles with I had various little weights that I would put in there, but 40 pounds or maybe 70 pounds or, you know, I'd switch it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for training. I also took my bow with me down there, which is pretty comical, because I showed up onto this military base in the middle of Central America there was a package waiting for me at this little tiny post office that they had. And it was a bow target, and they were like, what the heck is this thing, man? And here I am. So I'm getting off the airplane in this country, and I'm carrying around a bow case and an army duffel bag that's full of gear and clothes. And it was pretty cool. So I ended up having to deal with like the base commander and to get all these approvals to be able to shoot my bow on the base. But I still took it with me. I made it work, and I took that bow with me so I could train shoot anytime I wanted to. Yeah.
So how long were you down there in South America before, I mean, did you have time to get back and stay quote unquote stabilize before you went out onto your hunt, or was it right away?
It was right away. So I got home I want to say I got home like September 2nd or 3rd. And then we were supposed to leave on the 10th or 12th, or basically I had like a week to 2 weeks of being home. And that time that I was home, there was no, I spent every moment I had with my wife, you know, because I already felt bad enough because I had already been gone for, I want to say I was gone for about 6 months, maybe seven, and no, 6 months. It was right at 6 months. And I came home and she already knew. I mean, this was all pre-planned. It's not like I came home and said, hey, gotta go, I'm leaving for another week and a half, you know, but, so I spent every moment I had, and I was doing stuff around the house that hadn't been done in 6 months. And we were going on little short trips, and I was taking her out, and we're doing all this stuff. So I didn't get a lot of additional training in. And then one thing I wanted to go back to. To speed up my training when I was deployed, one thing that I did was I got involved in some of those, I don't remember the name of it, but you hear a lot of them. It's a fitness program that's designed around mountains,
like
right?
Mountain Tough or something like that?
Yeah, there you go. Mountain Tough, or I don't remember the name of all of them. There's a whole bunch of them. And I started doing one of those, and I actually got injured in like July. I'd hurt my ankle pretty bad doing a bunch of jumpy things or something, burpees or something. And I hurt my ankle. And then I had to go about another month without training because I literally could hardly even stand when I was down there. So I think what I'm trying to say is I didn't really get a lot of training in except for some weighted pack hikes.
Okay. So then, So just minor, you know, you didn't go into some kind of crazy fitness program for multiple months to get.
No.
Okay.
No. And I still don't do that. Yeah. I still don't. I don't. I eat my Dairy Queen blizzards and
those are really dangerous for me, man. Those are dangerous. Well, like I'm an dangerous. Ice cream guy. I'm an ice cream guy.
My wife told me she wants to do, we do these little monthly challenges. One might be push-ups, one might be sit-ups or something. And she told me she wants to do no dairy April. And I told her last night, I said, well, I guess I'm going to Dairy Queen every day the rest of this week. I got to get my blizzards in.
That's right.
Go no dairy.
Right.
So, but yeah, I don't, I still work out. I run every morning. I get out, I run or walk, or I do some sort of forward motion for like 4 or 5 miles every morning. And then any opportunity I get to get out in the mountains, I go hike. Gotcha. And that's really all I don't do a bunch of extra stuff. I just do normal stuff.
Yeah. Well, what about the first trip? You show up. And so like for me, the very first time I ever went elk hunting, got into the car in Iowa, drove 19 straight hours out to Idaho, got out of the car, got my pack on, went straight up the hill. And I'll tell you, before I even got the camp set up, I was wrecked. Right?
Like you can still see the truck.
Oh, well, I mean, no, I was like,
the truck. I can't go any further.
Well, I mean, like physically I was wrecked. Yeah, like, like no acclimation time. And now what I do whenever I go out to Colorado, I give myself at least 24 hours before I even go up and start to do any type of activity. And I'll tell you that helps me. Right. And you know, I go
for sure. Absolutely.
Get out there, go to my buddy's house. Typically we find, we show up late at night, like 8 or 9 o'clock, spend the night, go up to where we hunt out of, and then spend the night there. And then that next morning we're off to the races. So there's like this 24 hour, maybe even a little bit more period where the body's acclimated. I'm somewhere around 7,000. Then we go up to about 10,000. Then that's where our camp is. And then I'm ready to go at that point, start drinking a lot of water, no more alcohol, all that stuff. Your first hunt, I mean, physically did you struggle or did you do all right?
I did. No, I struggled, but I think anybody struggles a little bit, regardless of where you're at.
Yeah.
But I had a little bit better than my buddy, and I'll expand on that a little bit more too. I drove from San Antonio, Texas, which is like 600 or 800 feet above sea level.
Yeah.
One of my hunting buddies was driving from Indiana, also about 600 or 800 feet above sea level. I drove straight through from San Antonio to Colorado and I got a hotel room. But when I got there, I went up in the mountains. I got up to about 8,000 feet, hiked around a little bit, spent the night in the hotel room, stayed at, I was still at elevation and all of that. Well, that my friend didn't come in until the next day. And he ended up struggling pretty hard with that first hunt that we did.
Yeah.
He was in pretty bad shape, and I wasn't too bad. Like I never had any issues with elevation. It was just, I guess the issues with elevation was just the lack of wind and sore legs and all of that. But like I said, I don't care who you are. I still get that now when I hike here in the mountain. I live at over a mile high and I still struggle when I go in the mountains. I still breathe heavy and
I think the best.
Yeah, but my friend, so my buddy, he really struggled, and the first day that we went, we were going in. We started at, I want to say the trailhead was about 8,000, maybe 8,500. I don't remember. And we hiked up. We got to 10,500, and that was it. My friend totally shut down and was not going to go another foot higher. And we actually, he was kind of panicking a little bit, and we ended up having to come off of the mountain. We went all the way back down to the trailhead, loaded up the trucks, and we ended up setting up a base camp down at the bottom. And he ended up taking the following day off. And me and another friend went hunting, and our other buddy, he had to stay down at base camp for that day because it really affected him pretty badly.
Yeah.
And I, looking back, we all talked about it after the hunt, and we said that might not have been the best way to approach that. Obviously, we should have probably hunted around 9,000 feet for that first day, and then, you know, it increased our elevation. Because I think it was two days after he took that day off, we went to a different area, and by that time we got to 11,000 feet, and yeah, we didn't really struggle. I mean, we didn't hike that far. We started at 9,500 and hiked up to 11, but we all did just fine. But yeah, by that time we had 3 or 4 days of that acclimation, and it was much easier.
Yeah, I tell you what, that time for acclimation is big if you're
asking me. Really is. It really is.
So, you know, you have these guests on a podcast just like me, and me personally, yep, I try to take something away from any guest that I can, mm-hmm, whether it's someone just like me who has a family, and I guess when I say just like me, I mean just like me before I was doing what I'm doing full time, right? When I was working those, mm-hmm, you know, those 40 plus hour, you know, a week jobs, and you have family and you have other responsibilities and whatnot. From all the guests that you've had on your podcast in regards to a new backcountry hunter, backcountry rookie, what's some of the best advice that you've ever gotten from a guest or another hunter?
I think probably communication.
Yeah.
And I say that I actually just did on my channel, I did a whole podcast on it where it was just me talking about communicating with my wife and my hunting partners. And that podcast, it wasn't just me coming up with random thoughts. It was stuff that I've learned through the podcast and through the last 4 years of being involved in this type of hunting. And communication is absolutely important. And I sat down with my wife after the first of the year, right before I started applying for different tags around the West. And we talked about, when does she want to go on vacation? Basically, when can I fit different hunts into different places? And that gave me a better idea of how I was going to apply for different tags. And then it also really clearly communicates, especially when you do it early in the year, it really clearly communicates to the spouse how much time you plan on being gone.
Yeah.
And the way that hunt is going to go. And if you've never done any of that stuff before, some of that could be really, really difficult on a family. It can be very stressful. I'm fortunate enough being in the military, and you hear how often I was deployed. My wife is used to it. So if I tell her I'm going to be gone for 10 days, she's like, okay, well, just try not to die out there, right? Like, try not to fall down the mountain and kill yourself. But she's used to me being gone for 2 weeks, and sometimes I won't even have signal.
Yeah.
And she's okay with that because we've done that. There's people that have never been away from their spouse overnight.
Yeah.
And then they're all of a sudden, hey, I'm going to be gone for 10 days. I don't know if I'm going to have cell phone signal. I'm going into the wild, right? The wild backcountry. And it might not be stressful to that hunter that's going out there, but that spouse on the back of their mind could be like, what the heck is going on here?
Right.
So I really think that communicating is really, really beneficial. And you can even, my wife doesn't really like podcasts. She certainly doesn't like to listen to me ramble on my own podcast, but if you can introduce them into the spouses, into some of those ideas through podcasts or watch this YouTube video with me or whatever, that kind of stuff helps too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's huge. And then on the flip side of that, not just your spouse, but your hunting partners too, because if you're coming up with some wild game plan in your mind about how you're going to do this hunt, and then your hunting partner may have something totally different in mind. You may be thinking that you're going to go 10 miles deep, you know, for 10 days. And your hunting partner's like, no, I'm setting up a base camp and I got coolers full of beer and I got steaks every night. Well, you're going to have trouble when you get to the trailhead. There's going to be some like we never talked about that kind of moments.
Yeah. Yeah. So one guy's thinking, hey, we're going back. One guy's saying we're hunting from the truck.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, I also don't, just as a side note, I don't advise that first year. If you've never been out west, I don't advise that 10 days back.
Oh, like, yeah.
It's not going to work out. Yeah. You're not going to stay back there 10 days. It's just not going to happen. I'd like to recommend to people, set up a base camp and take a little lightweight tent with you and go out for a day and then come back to your tent, or go out for one night and then come back to your tent and sleep good for a night and then go do two nights or something.
Yeah.
But don't try to do that 10 days if you've never done that before.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I'll tell you this, man. My first experience going back in the backcountry, I had another guy with me. We set up and, you know, we were like 3 miles away from the truck and we were planning to stay 5 nights, but we gave ourselves, you know, like, hey, we're only 3 miles away if, we need to get back to the truck for extra supplies. Well, I based all of what I was taking in the next year, like this past year, when I went in October, I went 3.5 miles in this time, found a good place to camp. And there was lack of water. So I knew that going in, but I didn't realize like how much water I actually consumed in a day. You know, I never really calculated it. And of course, while I'm working out all day, making moves, you know, running up the hills and stuff. And, I planned for like 4 days back there by myself, but eventually, man, I was having to, and then my filter broke. So I was having to tab water. I carried water in with me, but then I was having to chlorine tab water while I was out there. And for those of you who've never drank it, like, that chlorine water does not taste like regular tap water. It tastes like shit.
And it very well could have shit right in it,
right?
You know, and you just don't even know.
Right.
But I think just having, at least having those tablets with you,
yeah,
gave you an extra day or two before you could come out.
And yeah.
There's times where people don't think about that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then they are 10 miles deep. And then it's a really,
a big deal.
Uh-oh kind of moment, man, where you're thinking, I am out of water. I don't have access to water. I don't have any way to treat water if I even find it. And what am I going to do?
Yep. So absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Anything else that you've kind of learned to do or not to do on some of these bigger hunts?
I move slow. That's something, a lot of times you will get that. You're into your mapping software, right? You're trying to figure out where you're going to go, and you got this perfect spot that you just know there's a herd of elk sitting there waiting on you, and you hustle, and you cover 4 or 5 miles as fast as you possibly can to get there, and you probably just passed 5 or 6 shooter bulls to get there. That's happened to me multiple times where I got my head down, probably looking at my maps, trying to figure out where I'm going. And I look up and I see elk running away from me because I just spooked them out of there.
Yeah.
If you just slow down and take your time and get there, the probability of seeing animals, it goes up, right? If you take your time, you look around, pull your binos out occasionally, look around, look under those trees, look through the trees. And you may see something that's much closer to the truck, and try to stay kind of quiet, laughing and giggling as you're, telling stories with your buddies as you're walking up the trailhead. It goes to the same thing. Just because you think you have a great spot on a map doesn't mean there's not another great spot that you're walking past. And if you're making a whole bunch of noise as you're walking past it, you could just blow everything out of there for the next few days.
Yeah. So, Any examples of adversity that you've kind of had to go through in the field, right? Obviously, we plan for both best and worst case scenarios, right? That's why we bring first aid kits or stuff to actually gut or clean a deer or an elk or whatever. You know, we plan for success and we plan for defeat. Any kind of adversity that you had to go through in the field, like obviously that example of your buddy basically going on lockdown, having to come off the mountain is a good one. But any other examples of you like starting to struggle, whether it's finding game or the physical side of it, or you're running out of water or food and you're just like, man, we better err on the side of caution and get out of here.
So I think my best example of adversity is that one of with my friend. And I've got a couple more stories that I'll tell too, and they're all quick, but I wanted to talk more about the one with my buddy, because that one was bad enough that it took two of us to get him off of the mountain. There was three of us total. And he ended up to the point where we were carrying his pack and we were filtering water for him because he was out of water. And he was really in a bad spot. And it just took that extra couple of guys to get him there. And so fortunately, he was a prior military guy, and he was out there with myself and another guy that was military also. And struggling to get off the mountain's not the worst thing that any of us had ever faced. So it wasn't like a really stressful situation. But I think if people have never been put in a situation like that, it really could have turned into a very serious thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We just slowed down. He's taken off some layers, trying to cool off. And we just got him down to at least the bottom. And then we sat down and took a break, filtered water, got it cleaned out. We tried to get him some food, took all of that. Like I said, we took his pack off of him and we just got all that weight off of him. And then we took our time. Once we hit that level ground back to, you know, 8,000 or 8,500 feet, we really walked slow to get back out to the trucks, and we took our time. So we didn't try to rush anything, and we just dealt with that situation.
Yeah.
Adversity with game, man, sometimes it just happens. You just don't find game
right
until the last day. And it's funny that you say the last day. It's almost like saying, well, I found that thing that I lost in the last place that I left it, you know?
Yeah.
The last day could be day five on a 10-day hunt if you shoot something. But it really could happen where down to the day the season closes. And if you give up 2 days before the season closes, you're really giving yourself – you're quitting 2 days early. You're going home 2 days early without maybe putting yourself into those opportunities. So if you plan for 10 days – you need to hunt for 10 days.
Yeah.
You need to stay out there because those, when we were in Arizona, my javelina that I shot, I shot that on the last evening of the last day.
Yeah.
And then my 2 years ago, I shot a coos deer in Arizona and I shot that at 4:00 PM on my last day of hunting. I was going home. I was going back to camp and packing everything up, sleeping for the night and getting up as early as I could and leaving the next morning. And I shot it just before it started to get dark. So staying until that last minute just opens up additional, well, not really additional opportunity. It gives you every opportunity that you could possibly have to get something.
Yeah.
Man. And I think as it starts to grind down on that last day, I think people just start hunting harder and they start like, it becomes almost a, I got to get it done kind of mentality. And I just think you spend more time, you look harder, you push harder, you walk farther.
Right. I'll tell you what, that's one thing that I struggle with, especially when I'm by myself. You know, obviously when you're with another guy, there's a set schedule, right? And, you know, let's say one guy tags out, obviously the next guy wants to try to tag out too. But with me, one thing that I fall victim to is this. So I say I'm going to be gone 8 days, you know, a day of driving on the front, a day of driving on the back. So I have six huntable days. And so I get out there, hunt. And then you start communicating. Like for me, I communicate with the wife and the wife is like, you know, oh, it's, you know, kind of struggle here. You know, the kids are acting up. And the last trip that I went on was a real struggle because my son actually told his teacher that the reason I'm going to be naughty is because my dad's not here. So I was like, what? Thanks, buddy. Like throw me under a bus. Yeah, yeah. So I started to feel a little guilty about not being home. And so I cut my trip a day short. And I was like, well, mm-hmm. you know, I better get out of here and go. And I know that I needed to be out in the woods, but I felt like if I was, you know, I also needed to be at home too. So there's the sacrifice that I'm still learning how to balance, you know, the my will to be out and do these things and also my responsibility as a husband and father.
Yeah. Yep. And I absolutely. And it just to me, again, I'm really lucky because I've been away from family multiple yeah. times and for long periods of time. So it isn't a thing for us, but I can totally understand how some guys are. We did a really great, one of my favorite podcasts I've done was with a guy named Jason Holliday he's an Ohio guy. And Jason is one of those guys that's just full of humility, right? He doesn't care about admitting when things have gone wrong for him. Yeah. And that's one of the things that he talks about is not like he's never really been away from his, can you hear me, Dan?
Yep, sorry. I can.
Okay. He's never really been away from his wife for long periods of time.
Yeah.
And I just think that, I mean, that can really, and if you have kids and, you know, you start to add all that stuff in there, it really plays a role in that.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. So
that can be tough. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then one other thing about adversity that I'll bring up, I think gets overlooked a lot of times, is losing game. The loss of game can destroy
yeah.
a hunt, and you have to stay in it. And so this year I talked about shooting that javelina in Arizona. Well, 2 days before I shot that javelina, I had shot a mule deer, and it wasn't a great shot. I won't even say it was okay. It was back a little bit, and it hit that deer pretty hard, and I knew he was hit, but he was chasing a doe and whatever. I could go on and on about the story, but we ended up backing out because we knew if we kept pushing him, we were going to push this doe that he was rutting on. And when we pushed the doe, he was going with her. So we decided we were going to back out and hopefully they would stay in that area where where I shot him, and we would be able to find him the next morning. Well, we went back in the next morning, and that deer was completely destroyed to coyotes. Yeah. 100% gone. 100%. Even the rib meat between the ribs was eaten out of that thing.
Yeah.
And I could have hung it up right there, right? I tagged him. I mean, I didn't just walk away from it and go try yeah. to shoot another deer. I tagged him. I shot my animal, and I lost my animal. And I knew that I killed that animal, so I tagged it. But I think oftentimes that would really get people down, and I think it could ruin a hunt at that point.
Yeah.
But we kind of understood what happened. We felt like I still feel like we did the right thing by backing out that night. And I had a tag in my pocket, and we continued to try to fill that tag.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's another thing that can bring a hunt down for sure. Yeah.
I'll tell you, it plays a huge impact on the mentality of a person, because I, not this past year, but the year before, I shot a mule deer and only got a single lung on him. I'm pretty sure it was a single lung hit, and followed blood. I was like, he's dead, he's dead, he's dead. And then, you know, maybe I pushed him too hard, maybe he wasn't hit as bad as I thought, whatever. Spent the entire day evening looking for him, spent the entire next day looking for him. Then a blizzard came in and we were pretty much forced to back out, but it really mentally it kind of kicked me in the nuts, and I was upset at myself for not getting the job done.
But it happens.
Yeah.
It happens all the time. And I think I mentioned something about social media and YouTube and all these things in the beginning, but a lot of this stuff isn't told, and these stories aren't told.
Absolutely.
Because they're not the 180 class mule deer stories, and people aren't talking about that kind of stuff. And I talked about it in detail on the Backcountry Rookies podcast about just losing an animal. I mean, there really was no way going back to that story that I told. I think if we would have pushed those deer that night, we would have pushed him much further away, and the same thing would have happened. He would have died 2 miles or a mile from where we were at.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would have had to track him all day the next day.
Right.
or we could back out and let him die where he was at. But either way, those coyotes were so hungry out there. Clearly they were hungry.
Yeah.
And they just came in and destroyed that thing. So it happens.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yes, it does. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, Chad, we could sit here for another 2 hours and just run through.
Easily, man. Yeah. I always have a good time talking to you.
Yeah, run through it all. But, you know, if people want to find out more about Backcountry Rookies, what you're trying to preach over there, and the message you're trying to get across, how do we find you?
Yep, absolutely. Everything is Backcountry Rookies. We have an Instagram account, and we have a webpage that we update every now and then with our latest podcasts and stuff. But you're better to just go to wherever you search for a podcast or wherever you listen to a podcast and look for Backcountry Rookies, or check us out on Instagram.
Yep.
We're on Facebook too. I don't do a lot of Facebook stuff, but we also have a really cool private group on Facebook. It's called the Backcountry Rookies Nation.
Yep.
And I think there's about 5,000 people in there now. So it's a pretty good group. And that, if I spend time on Facebook, it's usually on that page, because we try to manage it. We try to keep all sales, any ad, like, it's just good conversation. Yeah. And anything that's not conversational, we try to remove it. We miss some stuff. There's probably some sales stuff in there. We miss some, but it's a good place to go, especially for questions. Guys that are new to backcountry hunting or want to learn more, there's, ask your question. You're going to get a good answer. And if somebody's being an asshole on there, then we remove them from the page and get, you know, we get rid of them. We just don't like the biased answer.
Positive energy only.
Yeah, that's the way we try to go with it over there. So it's a good spot.
Yep. Well, Chad, man, appreciate your time. Thanks again. And oh, hey, real quick, man, what do you got going on this fall? Like, what do you have going on for hunts?
I really can't answer that yet. I don't have the applications are in. I applied for Arizona and I didn't draw anything in Arizona. I couldn't draw deer because I shot that deer in January. So, likely next year I'll go back to Arizona again for the January hunt. I will most likely draw a Colorado elk tag with a rifle and a muzzleloader mule deer tag in New Mexico, but I don't know about my New Mexico elk or any of the other species yet. They released the draw results April 28th. So until then, just kind of waiting to see what we get, but I'll be out goofing around somewhere.
Gotcha. Well, hey man, good luck in this fall.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Good luck to you too.
Thank you for listening to the Backcountry Rookies podcast. Don't forget to look us up on social media. We are Backcountry Rookies on all the spots, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. And we also have the Backcountry Rookies Nation, which is a private group on Facebook. So thanks to Go Hunt, Elk 101, Vortex Optics, and Canyon Coolers for sponsoring the show. Remember, when you use the code ROOKIES, you get special deals at all of those companies. You get $50 in gear shop credit when you become a Go Hunt Insider. Save $20 on the University of Elk Hunting from Elk 101, 20% off any Vortex apparel. And now you can save 10% off Canyon Coolers. Just use the code ROOKIES at any of those places and get special deals. Thanks for listening. Come back next week. Out of here.